All right, it's 3:05. Welcome to the Monday, May 17th meeting of the Committee on Environment and Energy. Today we are taking up the Marcellus Shale gas development issue. This is our second meeting on this issue. At our first meeting, we had some environmental advocates come in and speak on behalf of some sort of potentially some sort of a ban, either in the watershed or statewide. And then we felt that as to be open and fair, we wanted to bring everybody in. So today we're going to be joined by New York State DEC, New York City DEP, as well as a number of gentlemen who have joined us from the Independent Oil and Gas Association. So welcome, everybody. At the table, we're joined by Legislator Tom Avenatti, Legislator Judy Myers, as well as Paul Conrad, a hydrologist with the Independent Oil and Gas Association. Welcome, everybody. And just for the record, who do we have on the phone, please?
Sue Bradgill, Independent Oil and Gas Association.
Yeah. Sue Gruskin, Executive Deputy Commissioner, New York State DEC.
Okay.
Carter Strickland, Deputy Commissioner for Sustainability, New York City DEP.
Okay.
Hi, Sue.
Connie Coker, Rockland County Legislator, Chairwoman of the Environmental Committee.
Okay, Connie, thank you. All right, thanks, everybody. What I'd like to do just structurally, if you'll bear with me, I understand a couple of the participants are on time constraint. Mr. Gruskin and I believe Mr. Strickland have just a narrow window of time. So what I thought we would do is we would dedicate the first part of the meeting for DEC and DEP, and then the second half of the meeting we'll devote to the Independent Oil and Gas Association folks. So we get everybody in, and we'll have plenty of time for legislative questions and feedback from the public. So does that sound like a plan? Okay.
Sounds like a
hearing no objection.
That's right, hearing no objection. We're joined also by Legislator Alfreda Williams. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. So, Mr. Gruskin, perhaps why don't we start with you as Executive Deputy Commissioner of DEC. I know some actions have been taken by the Commissioner recently. Why don't you bring us up to date on some of the things that have happened and you know, if you have an official statement to make or an unofficial statement to make from DEC's point of view.
Okay, well, I don't have an official statement to make, but I can spend a couple of minutes just describing what the process is and where we're at in the process. And I think I first want to start by pointing out that DEC's role in this is not as an advocate in any respect. So you mentioned you heard from some of the environmental groups, and I know Brad is on the phone. How are you, Brad?
Good, thanks.
On behalf of industry, that we are the regulator here. And from the time that we've gotten into this, it's been on the basis that under the state environmental conservation law, we have an obligation to regulate oil and gas drilling in New York State. And under Article 23, it is a legal activity in New York State. And when this idea of high-volume horizontal drilling and hydrofracking came along, we recognized that our existing regulatory structure, which was based upon a generic environmental impact statement, did not cover all of what we thought would be the environmental impacts of this process. So at that point, we began to engage in a formal administrative process to supplement the generic environmental impact statement. And for those of you who may not be that familiar with the way these sorts of things work, the purpose of a generic environmental impact statement is to cover activities where there's going to be a lot of common issues. So with oil and gas drilling, since most of the permit applications had a lot in common, they had generic aspects to them. In 1992, we issued a generic environmental impact statement so that as long as the application stayed within the parameters of the generic environmental impact statement, an individual environmental impact statement wasn't required. So what we did was identify where we thought there was a delta of issues that were that fell outside the scope of the existing GEIS that needed to be covered in a supplement. We began this process of first identifying those issues, so we went through a scoping process where we held public hearings and received about 3,000 comments from the public. We came out with a draft scope. After that, we prepared a draft supplement to the generic environmental impact statement. It was about 800 pages. It came out at the end of last year. We conducted a series of hearings around the state, which I actually conducted them, and we received about 14,000 comments on the draft. And right now, we are in the process of evaluating those comments, and under the administrative rules that are applicable to this, we are required to do a responsiveness summary where we explain how we're going to respond to each of those comments in the final document, and then we have to make seeker findings, and then ultimately come out with the final supplement. So we're at a point where we are still in the review and analysis stage with those comments. I've just given you a very shorthand explanation of activity that's taken 2 years and an enormous amount of resources. The most recent activity on this that I think you're referring to is when we announced a couple of weeks ago that we decided that because there's only two unfiltered surface water systems in the state, and the issues that relate to those that have to do with the ability to maintain filtration avoidance determinations from the that exempt those water supplies from the federal requirements that would otherwise apply, that those really should not be considered generic issues. Those issues have, for the most part, have to do with things like sedimentation and turbidity that actually are not material in virtually, you know, every other place of the state where this activity might take place. So where there's water that comes from underground aquifers, it's immaterial, and where there's filtered water supplies, it's immaterial. So we announced that as we're going through this process, we decided that we would not consider those areas, which are the New York City watershed and the Skaneateles Lake watershed that services Syracuse, that those would not be included in the generic review, but that if somebody wanted to at some point make an application to drill in those areas, they would have to do their own separate environmental impact statement that in addition to complying with whatever requirements we say generically apply everywhere in the state, would also have to address the unique and specific issues that relate to filtration avoidance determinations. And so that's it in a nutshell. And I think it's probably better for me to answer questions than, you know, I could talk for a couple of hours on this as I have various seminars and so on. But I'd be happy to answer any questions here.
All right, thank you. It's Pete Harkham again. Just for the record, quick update. We've been joined by Legislator Rogowski and
Jim Smith from Independent Oil and Gas Association.
Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us. For those who are just joining us, what we're going to do, just for the purposes of discussion, since some people are on tighter schedules than others, the first part of the discussion will be focused on Stuart Gruskin from DEC and Carter Strickland from DEP. And then the second half of the meeting, our participants from the Independent Oil and Gas Association will allow them to present and questions that way as well. All right, thank you. Let me start off with a couple questions, then we'll open it up to other legislators. So then, what are the next steps involved in environmentally from DEC's point of view? You brought us up to date where you are. What's next?
Well, next is really for us to continue the process of reviewing and analyzing the comments. We're peer reviewing some of the studies. We got comments that really range from very sophisticated technical reports. For example, New York City gave us a very comprehensive submission, as did Riverkeeper and a bunch of the other environmental organizations. We received many thoughtful comments from highway superintendents, town supervisors, local government officials in the regions where drilling is going to take place, because they have a host of issues that relate not just to the general environmental safety of the drilling, but also local infrastructure concerns and other kind of community concerns. We also received good technical comments from industry and from academic people at academic institutions. So we're in the process of reviewing all of that, and the next tangible step would be when we come out with a revision to the supplement and a responsiveness summary to explain where we felt we needed to make changes, where we didn't feel we needed to make changes, and how we otherwise would deal with the comments. And I can't give a timeline for that because we're not really operating under a specific time constraint. We've been doing this on the basis of taking the amount of time that's necessary to do the job right. So we're still operating under that.
Okay, along the same vein then, when we're talking about regulatory bodies, how do these interstate compacts figure into your authority? For instance, we've learned that the Delaware River Basin Interstate Compact is about to issue or intends to issue regulations for natural gas in exploration in the shale formations in the Delaware River Basin. Does that impact on your jurisdiction and your authority? Do you overlap? What's the relationship there?
Yeah, there are some overlaps with the DRBC, which is Delaware River Basin Commission, SRBC, Susquehanna River Basin Commission, and I think there are also requirements under the Great Lakes Compact that would stretch into the areas here. The jurisdiction that those entities have actually go to water consumption, and right now, DEC actually does not have regulatory authority over water consumption, actually pulling out water out of the ground for commercial purposes. We do for drinking water, but not for commercial use of the water. So our regulatory hook, so to speak, is in the seeker process. And so both DRBC and SRBC, which have to approve withdrawals from within their basins, have been studying this issue and, primarily looking at, what will the impacts be of the water consumption within those basins? We've looked at it in our draft SGIS, primarily from the perspective of what the impacts would be on stream flows and aquatic life. And I will add that there's a bill that's pending in the legislature to actually give us regulatory authority over water withdrawals, commercial water withdrawals, that we think is an important gap that needs to be addressed. But in the meantime, within the areas covered by SRBC and DRBC, they are doing that, but they do not preempt us. So even if somebody gets a permit from SRBC or DRBC, they still need to go through the New York State permitting process. And we work very closely. We're on the boards of both entities, and we work very closely professionally with them and their staff on trying to address these issues.
So it's Judy Myers here. So they are the ones who are currently charged with regulating them?
Well, they're charged with regulating actual amounts of water withdrawals.
Uh-huh.
So within the basins, they have the ability, if you want to withdraw water from the basin, you have to go and get a permit from them. They're not issuing drilling permits, for example.
That's you.
But it just has to do with the water.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And even if someone comes with a DRBC or SRBC permit in hand, all that means is that they have permission from that body to pull water out. It doesn't mean that they have the right to use that water in a drilling operation. They would still need our approval for it.
I understand.
And the requirements that we put into the SGIS are actually a little bit different from the analysis that's used by those entities when it comes to stream flows.
Thank you.
Okay. I have another couple questions, and then we'll open it up. Getting back to the filtration avoidance and the unique and specific environmental review that would need to take place in those two watersheds, how is that memorialized? Is that done through regulation? How is that memorialized?
Well, when we come out with a final supplement, it will only apply to what is indicated in it, and it will specifically not apply to areas that have filtration avoidance determinations. So I think the way to look at it is that if you have a permit application that falls within the parameters of the SGIS, then you won't have to do any additional environmental impact studies. And, you know, when you come in with your permit application, you have to say, okay, here I fall within these parameters. It will be clear from the document that any application within an area that has a filtration avoidance determination, you know, as an unfiltered surface water supply, will not fall within it. So it's just not going to cover it. And then they'll have to do their own supplement, or actually their own supplementary EIS.
Okay.
This is Carter Strickland. I'm going to interject there.
Yeah.
In this press release of April 23rd, the state said, and we applauded them for doing so, that they would work with us to, and state DOH on, you know, additional drilling restrictions in these areas. So that's something that we're very much interested in following up with them on.
Right. And let me, I can add to that, Carter, that when we, you know, when it comes to figuring out, really the next step is then, okay, what else would be required, and what we've indicated to, you know, pretty much everyone who's interested, is that we want to work with the communities that are affected, as well as the State Department of Health, who has primacy now in the New York City watershed. And, you know, the Department of Health is really the primary regulator of the safety of drinking water supplies. So they should have an important voice as we, at some point, get to the issue of, okay, well, what is it that a permit applicant would have to demonstrate or address as part of a supplement in one of these very sensitive and unique areas?
All right, the last question I have deals with, you know, you've made it clear that you're not for it, you're not against it, you're the regulator, and you're going through the process as a regulator. As a legislature, we have, of course, are very tuned to budgets and staffing issues and union issues. So forgive me for asking this so directly, but we know that a DEC union is vocally opposed to this. Does that cause conflicts for you to be in conflict with staff like that, or is that you know what is that? I guess.
No, I get, you know, the union had the same right as any other interested person or entity to comment on the draft document, and I'm not privy to the discussions that took place between union leadership and the members and so on, and I'm not going to, you know, get into any of sort of the scuttlebutt that I heard about that, but it really doesn't present a conflict. You know, this is, DEC staff has been dedicating enormous amounts of time and their expertise across multiple divisions to this initiative. We have people from Mineral Resources, Division of Water, Division of Air, Fish and Wildlife, our legal office, all working on the various facets of this problem. And, you know, they understand that their job is to make sure that whatever environmental issues may arise out of this are dealt with. And the reason that it's taking us as long as it is taking us is because we do believe that there are serious environmental issues here, and they've got to be dealt with in a comprehensive way. So I have absolutely no lack of confidence or belief that there's any conflicted staff. I think that the people who are working on this are all, you know, doing their jobs admirably.
Okay, members, questions for Mr. Gruskin. Mr. Rogowski.
Yeah, this is Legislator Rogowski. Commissioner Gruskin, it seems like the last comment you made about taking a comprehensive look at the environmental issues, they're very important issues. It strikes me that an approach DEC might have taken, and whether you did this with DOH or just through your activities, but going through the whole process, as you said, several years of a generic environmental impact statement, looking at all the issues, seems to me you might have had as one of your options the decision to just permanently prohibit drilling in those two watersheds, rather than, because the decision, whatever is used to, you made a decision to delay that decision to site-specific later on, you revisit that. So I'm just curious from, you know, someone who, I spent a lot of time with NEPA and SEACR, it seems to me this EIS process could have been an option. You might not have chosen it, but for among your possible decisions, if the GEIS had been drafted to potentially support, depending on what the analysis showed, support a decision to say in these watersheds, rather than delay that decision, simply part of our current decision will be, oh, those two watersheds, we're going to prohibit it based on the GEIS. Did you go down that road, and how do you support a decision to delay it?
I can address that. First, I think I'd probably take issue with the characterization that we're just delaying this, or, you know, somehow kicking the can down the road on it. What really, from a substantive standpoint, what we're saying is that we don't believe these issues are generic, and therefore they don't belong in a generic environmental impact statement. But to get to the point of prohibiting it, there's been no shortage of people who have been suggesting that this should just be prohibited in those areas. But you need to bear in mind that, I don't know the statistic in the skinny atlas-like area, but in the New York City area, 70% of the New York City watershed is privately owned. And if the state were to take action to prohibit people from realizing the value of the mineral rights, then arguably that would be a taking. And without, you know, trying to debate whether there are defenses to that or what the merits are, we would need to have a very strong basis for saying that we have established that there's a sufficient record to prohibit this. And we're not comfortable with that. We're not at that point where we think that would be appropriate. And, you know, fundamentally, it I think would be unfair to the people, the private landowners who are in that area, if there is a possibility at some point in time of this activity being able to be conducted safely in those areas. So I think it would be premature to do a prohibition and would raise potential constitutional problems. So we're taking the approach that if somebody wants to come into one of those areas, then they are going to have to clear the environmental hurdles of that are going to be outside of the generic environmental impact.
Well, I appreciate that answer. Not to belabor the point, but it seems to me, I don't necessarily agree with you, if down the road that site-specific EIS found problems, presumably that landowner would not be given the permit or whatever the regulatory scheme is to drill if there were certain issues. So I still think if you find environmental problems, someone doesn't have a right to pollute. They may own the water under their land, or they may own the shale under the land, the oil. But if drilling that up is going to create environmental problems so that DEC doesn't want to issue a permit, you're in your rights not to issue that permit, seems to me. So without getting into
what... But it's going to be site-specific.
Well, but wouldn't you have the
option? It's one thing to say, okay, in this area that's a very large area, we're just going to do a blanket prohibition. It's another thing to say, okay, there's an application in a specific place, and because there are steep slopes or because there are other geographic features that actually mean that there's going to be it's going to create a problem with water supplies and so on, then those are all factors that would get taken into account. But to suggest that we have an administrative basis today for doing a prohibition in, you know, this very large area that is, you know, the vast majority of it is privately owned, we you know, respectfully disagree and don't think that at this point that's the appropriate state action to take.
Okay, I just let me just make one final point. I appreciate that, Commissioner, but it just again, it's only because you're doing the GEIS. You know, when the Federal Highway Administration does a highway, if you break it up individually, everything may be okay individually. But you look at the whole highway being built, it's not a good thing. So I'm saying it seems you had the opportunity. You have the opportunity at the generic stage to look at the big picture, because any one property owner's drilling on their that's no big deal. Site specific, it's not a big impact. It's only when you look at it cumulatively. So again, to the chair's point, segmentation in the highway department. This FHA was notorious years ago for segmenting a project, only looking at a little piece at a time, and every piece was okay until you looked at the whole thing. So all I'm saying is, rather than segmenting every little property owner, if you look at the whole region, there might be a problem. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Okay, now I understand what you're saying, and we're, of course, well aware of the rules with segmentation, and you know, cumulative impacts is something that does need to be addressed in our generic review as well.
Okay.
So, but this may be a point at which we just, at this point, don't agree on.
Okay, no problem. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Just for the record, and for those of you on the phone, we've been joined by Legislator Testa, Legislator Kaplowitz. For the newcomers, right now we are speaking with Stuart Gruskin, Executive Deputy Commissioner of DEC. We're on to member questions. Once we get through member questions, we're going to go to Carter Strickland, Deputy Sustainability Commissioner of New York City DEP, for his statement and questions. And then the second half of the meeting, we'll be getting to the gentleman from the Independent Oil and Gas Association, because these gentlemen are under timeline. Okay, back to Mr. Gruskin. Any other questions from members? Okay. Sir, can we ask you to stay on the line? I know you're pressed for time, but if you can stay for a few minutes while we speak to Mr. Strickland, there may be some overlap there.
Absolutely. I'm very anxious to hear what Carter has to say.
Okay, thank you. So Carter, why don't we turn it over to you? Any kind of comments, statement, formal or otherwise, that you'd like to make on New York's position on all of this?
Sure, I'm happy to speak to you, but I will say my statement is an informal one.
Okay, that's fine.
I guess the first thing I'll do is to say that you know, no one needs to take notes, or, and I won't go on at length, because we just collected all our materials and put it on our website in a unique page. So that's everything I'm going to say.
What would that web address for those of us playing at home?
Sure, www.nyc.gov/DEP.
Perfect.
And that will be just press releases and the statements that we've in testimony we submitted. And, you know, so anything I say here will be distillation of that. And, you know, you'll see the full explanation there. And it is a lot. Stu alluded to the fact that we put in sophisticated comments. We appreciate these. I don't think he's just being nice, although he would be nice to us. But he, you know, we did spend some significant amount of money and time. We hired a joint venture led by Hazen and Sawyer, a consulting firm that's well known. They compiled a report, and we submitted that. We, like the rest of the public, had a deadline of the last day of 2009 to submit comments. It was extended by DEC, which we very much appreciated, and it allowed us to submit these comments. We had an engineering report, a legal document, formal comments on the SGEIS, or draft SGEIS, very long acronym, and we also, you'll see on our website, it's sort of distilled in a 10-page comment letter, which accompanied those. And it's probably the easiest thing to read, but you can, no pun intended, drill down as far as you can go into our comments. You know, we essentially had three concerns. We pointed out, first of all, that this water supply, it supplies water for 9 million people, half the people in the state. That's 8 million in New York City. We're actually 8.4 now, and about 1 million upstate residents who have the right under statute, and we're happy to sell it to them, to tap into our water. That includes, obviously, much, if not all, of Westchester. So, you know, it's pretty significant public service that we provide, and an essential one. We couldn't exist without water coming down here, so it's vitally important to the city. And so we think it's appropriate that there's a high bar for doing anything in our water. You know, the other thing we pointed out was that we do have a filtration avoidance determination. What that is a determination by EPA working with state DOH to make sure that our water is very clean. You may know that we have really two large watersheds. One is the old Croton one in Westchester, and there's the Catskill Delaware watershed upstate. The upstate one is what we're talking about, but by point of contrast, the east of Hudson or the old Croton watershed provides water on a seasonal basis, and that water we do have to filter, and we're spending a few billion dollars to build a filtration plant. If we had to do that on the other side, the cost would be very high, and it's hard to estimate because there's some old estimates that we put out there, but they really aren't designed to deal with the kind of contamination that is possible by hydrofracking. So those were our concerns. We have spent, you know, $1.5 billion or so on land acquisition and other elements of our watershed protection plan upstate. So that's of concern to us. And really, we have three major concerns. One, what we call invasive industrialization, really any land use changes in the watershed are of concern to us because of siltation and sedimentation, stormwater runoff, and the like. Secondly is the chemicals used in hydrofracking. And thirdly, water supply infrastructure. Both within and outside the New York City watershed, when you go to our website, you'll see these materials and maps, etc. But some of our aqueducts go outside of what is officially called a quote-unquote watershed. So we're concerned about buffers and setbacks, etc. for that. All of our concerns were set forth in comment documents to the state. We, like everybody else, are waiting for the state to respond to that. We have met with New York State legislators, our commissioner did, and went with some of those commissioners to some sites in Pennsylvania to check them out, and you can see some news items in that. There's a spot in right across the river from Hancock, Pennsylvania, that's experienced some contamination, and that is of concern to us. And that's where things stand now. I guess the last update you heard from Stu, and I'll just reiterate the point that the end of last month, D.C. carved out two watersheds, New York City watershed being of concern to us, from this SGIS. We think that's wonderful. That's great. Obviously, our comments on the generic are still submitted in before the state, and they will respond to that. But we applaud the step. We think it's a recognition of the special status is certainly appropriate, and we look forward to working with state DOH and DEC and our sister community in Syracuse to develop rules for these watersheds that will be appropriate.
I just want to jump in and point out, a few people have asked me this over time, that the fact that we decided that the FAD areas would not be treated as generic does not in any way excuse us from responding to the comments that the city put in, that the city's comments were not just limited to potential impacts on the FAD status, but were comprehensive, you know, with respect to the other environmental issues as well. And those we are going to continue to address and, you know, take advantage of the opportunity, you know, to review.
Okay, thanks. Peter Harkham here. I've got a question, and then again we'll open it up to members. In terms of watershed rules and regs, there was a lengthy rule development process, and new rules and regs just came out. Several of us here at the table represent districts in the watershed, you know, and we know how difficult it is just to get a septic system built in the watershed. Do you have specific rules and regulations that you have developed for mineral or for energy extraction in the watershed? Or do you plan to do that sort of thing?
I guess I'll pull in to do, but no, we don't, and furthermore, we can't. there's under the state mineral law, we're preempted.
Okay. Okay. Members.
Okay.
Pretty clear.
Okay. Okay. Note for the record, we're joined by Legislator Nona. Thank you for joining us. All right, Mr. Gruskin, Mr. Strickland, you're welcome to stay on the line if you wish. I know you both have other commitments, so if you hop off, we will not be offended. We're now going to turn it to our colleagues from the Independent Oil and Gas Association. Mr. Gill, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and we have Paul Conrad here and Jim Smith here.
John Conrad.
Oh, John Conrad. I'm sorry. John Conrad.
Excuse me. I'm going to then say goodbye and just let the committee know that if you do have any other questions or concerns about this, feel free to contact us at DC, and we'd be happy to provide additional information that you might need.
And thank you very much for your participation. We appreciate your time.
Sorry, Brad. I'll listen to you another time.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Okay. Well, welcome. Thank you all for joining us. We are not just the Environment Committee, we're also the Energy Committee. So we appreciate the work you do. We understand the vast amount of energy needed to run New York and the Northeast and our economy and the jobs you create. And legislatively, everything we do is a balancing act. The environment, jobs, energy extraction. And that's what we're doing today. We're in a balancing act. So we always want to hear from everybody. We want input from everybody. So we're glad you're here today. So why don't we, I'll turn it over to the three of you. You can each speak. All three of you can make a statement if you wish or however you want to do it, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Brad, do you want to start?
Sure. I can kick it off. Well, first, I'll just state that this is not a formal statement. This is just an informal discussion here.
Sure. That's fine.
Good. And I just really, on behalf of IOGA of New York and industry, just thank you folks for inviting us to participate in this and for wanting to have a fair and balanced meeting. We think that's very, very important and too often lacking in certain meetings around the state these days. And before I forget, I would appreciate it if you'd always keep the association in mind as a resource. If you ever have any questions, we'd be glad to be there and answer them for you. And I appreciate John Conrad and Jim Smith being there. I would have liked to have been there in person, but my schedule wouldn't allow. But I would look forward to meeting some of you in the near future in person. I'm really happy for this chance to engage in this dialogue and to answer questions and address concerns. We understand that people do have concerns, especially in that area of the state where they're less familiar with drilling. All concerns are valid. We understand and recognize that. There are several, in fact, maybe I should say many points in the resolution that are concerned, that I'm concerned with. Some don't appear to be based on science or a recognition of industry's track record in New York, but rather on assumptions and maybe fear of the unknown. But those are the kinds of things that we would welcome the chance to clarify and discuss. We feel there's a lot of misinformation in the public realm right now. We're just generally concerned that any actions that are taken are going to be born out of that misinformation, and we don't think that's a good place to be. If industry has done a poor job at anything over the years, it's not environmental protection, it's not an excellent safety record, it's not a good track record in general, but it's public education. And that's something that we are changing with our public education efforts over the past several years, and participating in meetings like this are just part of what we want to do. So rather than comment in detail about the resolution, line by line or bullet item.
We're not even up to that yet. So let's say big picture first.
Good. Yep. So I'll just end it by saying that like Stu said early on, we're here to answer questions, and I think that would probably be the most effective way to do this.
Okay. Well, thanks. Well, maybe one of you. We've heard as we've discussed, we've heard from environmental groups about what some of their concerns are, and in a big picture way. And I'm sure you've heard what some of the concerns expressed by environmental groups are. So maybe you could take us through, in a big picture way, your take on this, the environmental safety that you think is built into the, you know, try and address in a big picture way to start with some of the, you know, water quality, traffic on the roads, runoff, potential chemicals in the water, all those kind of things that we've heard about. If you could address some of those, that would be a good place to start, I think.
Sure.
And
John,
that's open all three of you.
I don't want to monopolize the conversation, John. Do you have anything that you want to say, or would you want to address any of those, or do you want me to continue?
Yes, John Conrad here. I'm a hydrogeologist and an environmental consultant and a member of IOGA and part of the public outreach committee of IOGA. And I've been following this all along. I've been to a lot of the DEC hearings. I've been doing a lot of forums similar to this one. And I think I know what the range of issues and concerns has been from various groups. And in my own mind, I've sort of categorized them. One of them is the chemical additives that are used in hydrofracking. Another is the overall adequacy of the SGEIS to address all of the various impacts. And a third really is this idea of when you inject this hydrofracking fluid into the Marcellus Shale. There's, I think, a misperception that there's a likelihood that those fluids and the chemicals in them will somehow come up to the surface, contaminate shallow drinking water aquifers, or surface water. And while I'm here today, because I think those three things are really central to a lot of people's questions, I'd like to take any questions that people might have about that. But if you don't mind, I'll just
please.
I have a few things to say about each of those.
Yeah, no, please do. This is your time.
One of the things to keep in mind is that the Marcellus Shale is at least 5,000 feet deep in New York, and sometimes deeper. And the process we're talking about, high-volume hydrofracking, involves drilling a well down into that shale unit and then drilling sideways for several thousand feet and then using water under high pressure to fracture that shale so that the gas is released. And the chemicals that are added only make up about 0.5% of that total fluid and are really there to make the water behave in a certain way so that the water and then the sand that they add is delivered to the fractures to open up the fractures and then keep them propped open. The hydrofracking fluid stays in the Marcellus during the couple of hours that it takes to fracture the formation, and then some percentage, maybe 15 or 20 or 30% of that fracturing fluid comes back up the hole and is captured and then, in most cases, reused. The remaining water that you injected stays in the Marcellus Shale and is released gradually during the life of the well as gas is released over many years or sometimes decades. But in all cases, the only exposure to the environment of those chemicals is as they are injected into the shale. They are not released to the environment when that water comes out, and there is really no likelihood that those chemicals are going to migrate from the Marcellus Shale upward to the shallow drinking water aquifers. And the SGEIS has done, I think, a very good job, a pretty rigorous job of proving this. If you look in, I think it's Appendix 11, they develop all of the hydrology and all of the theory that allows the DEC and me to say that there's no realistic chance that those chemicals could find their way to the surface. And it's also summarized in Chapter 5 of the SGEIS.
Now, didn't the Army Corps of Engineers comment on that in, where was it, in the Pittsburgh District in September of 2009 and March 2010? Didn't they call that total dissolved solids? Is that the same issue?
Well, total dissolved solids. It's really the saltiness of the water.
Okay.
The Marcellus Shale was formed in an ocean hundreds of millions of years ago, and for that reason the Marcellus is full of not only natural gas but salt water. And so when you produce gas, the water that comes back out is not just the hydrofracking fluid that you injected, it's also the natural brine that exists in the Marcellus Shale. And that brine has high total dissolved solids, mostly salts.
And do you think that New York would be any different than Pennsylvania? If the Corps had concerns in Pennsylvania, A, how is that addressed, and B, how would New York be different?
Well, it's one of the things I hoped would come up today, because when this water comes out of the ground, it's basically wastewater that has to be managed. It has to be either treated and reused or it has to be disposed of. And right now in New York, and I guess to some extent in Pennsylvania, there is not enough capacity in the treatment systems that we have in various communities to adequately treat what we think will be the flow of this wastewater once drilling ramps up in Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia. And so that's a challenge to industry that they're busy working on right now. You will not be issued a drilling permit in the state of New York unless, along with your permit application, you can show the DEC how much water you're going to use, where it's going to come from, and what you're going to do with the wastewater when you're done hydrofracking. And right now, as I said, there is not sufficient capacity to treat all of the water that will be brought to the surface during the once Marcellus drilling ramps up.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because those are two of the other questions I had. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can discuss that a little more. Is where does the huge amount of water come from that's needed to inject, whether it's piping or trucking? And then if we don't know how we're going to treat it, because we know that conventional wastewater treatment plants cannot handle this stuff, mm-hmm. what do we do with it? And are we racing ahead to try and, you know, get the jump on this, or should we be waiting until we have real world solutions for this stuff?
Well, industry is not waiting. Industry is already tackling the challenge, because they have to. If they don't solve this bottleneck, they're not going to be extracting Marcellus gas in very large amounts. And what's been happening over the last 6 months or a year is industry is developing ways of either treating and reusing the water to the maximum extent possible. That's the first choice. But to the extent that it needs to be disposed of, they're trying to come up with ways of disposing of it in ways that either doesn't involve the conventional treatment systems that are out there, or involves upgrading those systems so that they can handle the high total dissolved solids that we see in the Marcellus brine. So, for instance, just in the last few months, the industry has basically determined various ways of treating the initial flowback, the initial 15 or 20% of the water that comes out of the well after hydrofracking. They can now reuse 100% of that water. So it's not going to go to a disposal facility. It doesn't need to be treated. It just needs to be treated on site for a couple of parameters, and then it can be re-injected in the next well when they hydrofrack. So there's already a big push to do a lot of reuse and recycling. The other, for water that must be disposed of, there will be plants set up that, for instance, could distill and crystallize the water, extract the salt from the salt water, leaving you with distilled water and salt. And so, again, no discharge to the environment, containing all of the water and then converting it to either distilled water or salt.
What about the chemicals that had been injected that will come back up? What do we do with those?
Those are treated as part of the treatment process or disposal process. So, and it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the chemicals that are initially added to frack water are actually used up in the process of hydrofracking. They either adhere to the formation, or their acids are turned into salts or are neutralized. So the flowback doesn't necessarily contain a lot of the initial chemicals that were added to it.
Let me ask you one other question about water. One of the presentations I saw, discussed gas and other chemicals getting into aquifers and drinking water. And you're presenting that it's not often the case. I guess the question that I would ask then, is if you're that confident, this type of energy extraction is exempt from the jurisdiction of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Would you unexempt yourselves if you felt that strongly about it, that you would hold yourself up to that scrutiny? Because that's the thing that's scaring the heck out of people. I mean,
yeah.
The district I represent is all aquifer,
right.
And we're dealing with contamination just from nitrates from septic systems, which is bad enough, but at least we know what it is. People are scared to death of chemicals that they can't pronounce and all kinds of other stuff. That may give them some peace of mind.
Brad, let me answer this, and maybe you want to jump in then.
Sure.
The process of hydrofracking is not regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Congress and the EPA made a conscious decision some years back that this type of activity does not fall within the types of waste disposal that are subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. So that process is not covered by the Safe Drinking Water Act. However, this process, the gas industry in general, and the process of hydrofracking is subject to a whole host of regulations in New York. New York has a very robust environmental regulatory framework of environmental regulations and laws that protect soil and groundwater already. Then we talked earlier about how in 1992 the DEC put in place the generic environmental impact statement, a three-volume set of guidance that covers all of the steps involved in oil and gas extraction. And now we're adding to that, and in fact we're homing in on high-volume hydrofracking and horizontal drilling, and we have an 800-page volume that further specifies how that work is to be done. We also have a whole host of other federal regulations that do regulate the oil and gas industry, and the water basin commissions regulate water taking and water consumption within a lot of the Marcellus region. So I can say with confidence that there is more than enough of a regulatory framework here in New York to protect the environment. The DEC has more than enough latitude, and they exercise it to protect human health and the environment.
Okay.
Thanks, Peter. If I could just add to that by way of clarification, the Energy Policy Act of 05, it did amend the Underground Injection Control Program of the Safe Drinking Water Act to exclude hydraulic fracturing, but because the objective of that UIC program was to protect underground sources of water from contamination, but by underground injection of hazardous fluids. And this is not underground injection or storage. This is an activity where the majority of this water comes back, and as John pointed out, it is so isolated from any groundwater, much more so than other fracking that has taken place across the state, that it really doesn't fall under those guidelines. And of course, the EPA has studied hydrofracking in the past, September of 93 and in 95, and more recently June of 04, and in every case has found it to be safe and best managed by the states the way it is now.
Okay, members. Legislator Rogowski.
Thank you. To the point about the depth, and there's a certain logic, say, you're going down so deep, not anywhere near it, but and I have not read the entire. GEIS of the draft. So from a worst case, from a mitigation point of view, worst case analysis, what if there was an earthquake or something, all of a sudden at 5,000 feet, and if I gather this salt water comes up and enters the drinking water aquifer, what does the document say is, and how do you solve that problem, or is it not looked at as a possible worst case scenario?
Well, I think the scenario that you have here is there would be there could be a deep fault, for instance, that might intersect the Marcellus Shale, or in your example, an earthquake that somehow causes the fluid to move up and out of the Marcellus Shale where it otherwise would not have. I think it's difficult to really address scenarios like that, sort of sitting around a table and imagining them occurring. But my answer is an awful lot of things have to go wrong simultaneously for that to happen.
But is there analysis of what if?
I'm not saying it's not a bad exercise to go through. I've given it quite a bit of thought myself. Okay.
Just so the decision maker knows.
But here's my answer as a hydrogeologist. Mm-hmm. Let's say the example of the deep fault penetrating the Marcellus, and then something happens, and the frack water wants to travel back up that fault and to the surface. You're talking 5,000 feet, a mile of rock that overlies the Marcellus Shale. Some of it is very permeable and porous, so it can absorb a lot of fluid. Some of it is very tight and non-permeable and non-porous, and it acts as a barrier. And what would happen if fluid wants to travel up a fault, a full mile, vertical mile, it's going to find those permeable layers and bleed off into those layers, or it's going to hit barriers and that will impede its movement to the surface. So the idea that there's some sort of a conduit, sort of a pipe or a plane that's an opening, it's there is no realistic chance that water would travel a mile upward and intersect those shallow drinking water aquifers. Very, very unlikely.
Well, my hydrologist, I appreciate that answer. I guess the question to the DEC that's doing the document, they're the ones, is DEC doing that worst-case analysis and maybe, you know, laying out, your analysis may be the correct one, but it's helpful the public saw that.
Yes, and Appendix 11 is really where they develop and address these kinds of questions. And again, in Chapter 5, they go back to it and explain it in simpler terms.
Okay. Thank you.
And if I could just add to that quickly, just to give you an idea, that there are thousands and thousands of wells drilled and hydrofracked across the state, many of which are here in western New York, at much shallower depths than what we're talking with Marcellus development, in some cases 1,000 or 1,200 feet deep instead of over a mile deep. And those wells are hydrofracked. And, you know, there has been seismic activity in certainly in western New York and across the state, but we've never had a problem. We've never had contamination of a water supply from any fluids used in the hydrofracking process. And I think it's an important distinction to make the difference between methane migration in water and contamination from any kind of frack fluids. That has not occurred. And all across the state, in fact, we recognized back in the early 80s in a DEC report that there's a great occurrence of methane in water supplies that have nothing to do with drilling. And I know people that have issues with methane in their water supply. They're nowhere close to drilling in their town. So that's the natural reasons for that are a much more common occurrence than drilling. So I just want to point that out.
All right, but to your to your point, though, thank you for bringing that up about the methane migration, because we do know, maybe this occurs naturally without drilling, but we've also heard reports, you know, I'm sure we've all seen the photo of the infamous flaming mug of water from Pennsylvania. But it can occur, though, through drilling, can it not?
It can, and I won't say that there have never been an instance of that happening. It can if there's a cement failure or some a breach of the casing or something. But I have to say that is by far the exception. And if you actually look at the number of times that has occurred, it's extremely rare. And again, it's not contamination by the fluids used in the fracking process, and it's very easily remediated. Through squeeze jobs, you can re-cement the casing and remediate that problem, but because that gets the headlines, when you hear of that exception, but you don't hear of the hundreds and hundreds of wells drilled last year in the Marcellus that didn't occur to. So
one other point that in Dimock, Pennsylvania, is where we all know this happened, and it looks, I haven't seen an official report, but it looks like there was a failure of the cement that seals the casing in place. It might have been a bad cement job to begin with, but there was methane migration out of the well and into some nearby drinking water wells. It's important to know, and I think you may have just said it, Brad, but I'll say it again, that had nothing to do with hydraulic fracturing or horizontal drilling. That was the vertical leg of a gas well, and so that could have happened in really in any gas well that was being drilled there, or even a water well that was being drilled that hadn't been properly constructed. So it is the rare exception.
All right, let me ask one other question. I'm sorry, then I'll open it back to members. Let's talk about something that's a little less esoteric than, things thousands of feet down. Let's, on the surface, one of the things that we've learned is, for instance, we need hundreds if not thousands of trucks to service each individual pad. We need pipes coming in with water or trucks coming in with water. The transmission lines going out, sort of spidering the landscape. I live on a dirt road in a rural part of this county, which is not too dissimilar to that part of the state. Could you address whether those fears are overblown or whether there really is disruption, and how is that minimized to, dirt roads and runoff and pipes scattered and noise?
Well, there is no doubt.
Yeah,
go ahead, Brad.
No, sir. Well, okay, I'll take a stab at that, Peter. Thanks. A very good question. And in the first place, pipes, you know, on the surface, are if you're talking about like gathering lines, those are all buried, you know, for transportation of the gas. Where operators can in Pennsylvania, they're laying out their drilling plans in such a way that if they can drill a pad within 2 miles of another pad, they will lay out a temporary line and pump the water from one to the next instead of trucking it. So that minimizes the truck traffic. In many cases, the roads in Pennsylvania where they're drilling are not in the same condition or level of improvement that they are here in New York. But I've heard numerous cases where operators, by the way, would prefer to enter into road use agreements with the municipalities as opposed to bonding. We're finding that it works better on both sides, preferable. And in many cases, and I can cite some examples here in New York, the roads that have been used by the gas industry have actually been over-improved. Once it's all said and done, and remember it's a temporary process, so this only takes place over a course of a couple months. When it's over and done, the roads then are often left better than they were when they started. So I'm not going to, you know, downplay the concern over truck traffic and the impact on the roads, but I think that is all extremely manageable, and we're finding in Pennsylvania that it is working very well. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
I just wanted to, there was a question about noise too, Brad. Do you want to address that? I mean, you mentioned that the site is active for a couple of months, and then it's reclaimed. I just wanted to make sure you...
Oh, yeah, right. Well, I guess just, right, a recognition that it's a temporary activity and drilling rigs do run around the clock. I know that's a concern that some people do have also, that the rig runs 24/7, and yes, in fact, it does, because you can imagine the cost of these operations. So, but again, it's a very temporary activity, and when it's all said and done, there's not a drilling rig there. There's not a tall structure. It's a low collection of the equipment on the ground that is quiet and in most cases very very rarely noticed.
Okay, Legislator Tesla.
Thank you. I just had a couple quick questions before I had to go to another committee meeting. I'm interested in the technology itself. Is there any demonstration videos or diagrams or illustrations that show how this is done, and then the capturing of the gas and how that is done in that same location to show the displacement of the water and the gas?
I'm trying to think. That's a good question. We have a video that we've shown and can make available. I don't know how much it would go into addressing your question there as far as the water storage. It talks more about the actual drilling, the vertical and then turning horizontal, than the perforating and fracking process.
At some point in the process, the gas has to be captured with the water present, and that's the interesting part that people might want to see, to show how one can be done without the other one escaping.
Yeah, Brad.
Oh, yeah, it goes through a separator, right. There's a separating unit at the surface that will separate the water from the gas. That just is a you know, like a typically a vertical, looks like a tank or a vertical cylinder as a separator. But I can see what I can find and try to get that to you. I'd be glad to.
Brad, I'm thinking of that animation that we've shown before where they're showing the drilling and the cementing and the perforating and fracking and
right.
how the fluids come to the surface. Is that the one you're thinking
right,
of?
That was the one that I was referencing, that we could get that. You know, to anybody that would like to see that.
I think we should do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, if you can get it like to Chris Crane, that would be helpful.
And this one of, is
sure.
there any locations in Westchester being contemplated for this, or is this just
no.
all?
No.
This
no,
will not occur in Westchester.
No, the Marcellus does not occur
in Westchester. It's the watershed.
Yeah, I'm just making sure. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Legislator Kaplowitz.
To all of only folks, and if this was discussed before I came out, I apologize. Has anybody done, not that this is the final way to do it, but it would be interesting to see a cost-benefit analysis, throwing everything in, you know, to this boulevard of all the costs and all the benefits, and just try to get a real sense of trying to monetize, because there's so much thrown out there, and this is for me a particularly complicated one, because it's there's so many pieces to it, so many unknowns, and what it looks like, you know, we trying to get my hands around it. That's at least one analysis that I've often, you know, we all use to try to get to the bottom line, the societal good, the societal cost, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
So can we, has the industry done it? Has the DEC done it? Is there someone that can provide us on both sides of the equation? What is the cost and what do we get?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the answer is no, it hasn't been done, or at least I know it has not been done by industry. We considered an economic study over a year or a year and a half ago, and then we realized that this is such a moving target with technology and costs and even not really understanding in New York if the reservoir is going to be the same as in Pennsylvania. We ended up really hanging our hats on the economics that are coming out of Pennsylvania because that's where the activity is right now. So it's a tough one to get your hands around when you're not actually able to even operate, because right now we don't even fully understand exactly what the requirements will be that we'll operate under until the final document comes out.
Mr. Chairman, can I follow up?
Yeah, please.
Sir, I would think, interestingly enough, I would think the easier side would be the economics from the industry side. What does it cost? A range.
I mean,
the part that I would think we'd have a hard time trying to put a cost to would be the environmental side, the potential things that could occur, and what that would cost us
right.
in trying to remediate.
Right.
You know, those kind of things. So
yeah, sure. Well, and on the industry side, I mean, we certainly put numbers together. I mean, we know that there's going to be on the order of a couple $1 billion in value added to the state economy in the next several years, but it's hard to know without knowing the level of development. We don't know how many wells we'll be able to drill or when they'll be able to be drilled. But we do know that job creation in Pennsylvania has been incredible. We've taken a stab at some numbers on jobs, tax revenues that under our tax system stay local to the municipalities where the development occurs. So we have put some of those numbers together, yes.
It'd be interesting to see that, but Mr. Chairman, I mean, even there, you have to, as I understand the issue, some of the jobs are temporary jobs, right? There's construction jobs, so there's a dollar amount to that, and there's a boost to the local economy. But, you know, when you do these kind of analyses, you want to do a short, medium, and long-term analysis. You want to see, you know, construction job goes away. So yes,
right.
You know, what's a sustainable job, sustainable revenues, and the like. The other interesting thing, Mr. Chairman, about this is the only thing permanent about this is the gas and the fossil fuel that's down there. We're not, and things will change. It'll be neat to see. I mean, 10, 20, 30 years ago, when was this technology developed? My guess is there's a point in the past where this was not around, this technology. And it begs the question, at what point in the future, in hitting the graph, will there be better technology without these environmental risks that will allow for us to tap into? So what's the present value of that future benefit, and what's the future cost, probably diminished on the environmental side? It might pay in the analysis to wait. You know, it might pay to wait 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years. The gas isn't going anywhere, unless I guess Pennsylvania sucks it all up on us, but assuming it's still there, it'll still be there, and there might be new technology, hydrofracking. You know, it wasn't around 100 years ago. Was it around 50 years ago? Was it around 10 years ago? You know, at what point, it has to get better, just by definition, in terms of the environment. And that's part of, as a policymaker, it's kind of hard for us to understand, at what point do we interject ourselves into the process of taking, of mining it, at the lowest environmental cost, at the best present value benefit? And it could, by definition, be some time from now. When that is,
and that's a great point. And hydrofracking, for example, was developed in the 50s. It was commonplace by the 60s. The horizontal drilling was actually started in the late 40s. Drilled in the 1980s here in New York for the first time.
But is there technology? I'm sorry. There must be some new feature that has only been developed in the last 5 years. I mean, my computers, our technology, our cell phones, right? I mean, the industry, is it literally 1950s industry, or have there been some development?
No, not at all. I mean, you're right. It's constantly evolving, and
right.
But right now, I think the track record that industry can demonstrate tells us that we are at a point, especially given the regulations under which we operate in New York, that we can do this very, very safely. Your point to, you know, the gas isn't going anywhere is true, but what is going somewhere quickly are jobs. We have member companies that are building facilities right across the border in Pennsylvania, and they're hiring Pennsylvania workers as we're having this discussion. We have a number of companies who are moving 50% of their workforce to Pittsburgh right now, leaving Horseheads. Not shutting their office down, but half their laying off part of their workforce in New York here. So that's our concern, and we feel that right now it's not pitting environmental protection or a good safety record against an economic opportunity. Those can both take place very, very well right now. And of course, industry just wants a chance to prove that.
Can I just... Legislator Williams.
I don't know, you may have covered this while I was out of the room, but I've attended some presentations that indicate there's a tremendous amount of water used in hydrofracking. And my question is, has anyone discussed the cost of purifying that water? What happens to all that water, and who pays to purify for possible use? Is it possible to do that, number one? Number two, how much does it cost, and who pays for it?
Well, it's true. A good average might be 4 million gallons per hydrofrack event, and it is a lot of water. Fortunately, in the Northeast, we do have a lot of water resources available for that. So I think you correctly point out the real problem. It's not so much is there sufficient quantity for hydrofracking, but how do we manage the water once we've used it for hydrofracking? And we talked a little bit earlier how when it comes out, it is high in salt, it has hydrocarbons to it. Some of the water, about 15 or 20% right now, is being reused entirely. So when it comes back out, it's reused for hydraulic fracturing. A lot of the remaining water that comes out of the well comes out more gradually over the life of the well and is then going to be treated or disposed of through a whole, any number of combination of technologies. But in New York, it's important to understand that one thing that won't be tolerated, one thing that will not be permitted, is for that wastewater to be released into the environment. That's not happening. We have a lot of regs that are in place already and additional restrictions on this activity here in New York.
Well, wait a minute. What happens there? You're saying you reuse 15 to 20%. So what happens to the 80%? 4 million gallons we're talking about? And so what happens to the 80%?
It has to be treated to the point where it no longer has those problem constituents in it. So salt can be removed and heavy metals, at least to the point where it can be treated through conventional means.
And who pays for all of this treatment?
It's part of the cost of producing natural gas. Yeah.
So the industry pays for it, so it means it's passed on to consumer eventually, is that right?
It's part of the cost of the product, yeah.
Thank you.
The water usage, the volumes, or you want to talk about how?
Yeah, the water volumes that initially that are obtained for hydrofracking are taken out of wells. They can be taken out of surface water bodies, rivers, streams, ponds, and that activity. If you happen to fall within the Delaware or Susquehanna River basins, that is strictly regulated by the Basin Commissions. Any consumptive use on this order of magnitude, you have to apply for a permit in advance, obtain a permit, and then still go through all of the state permitting requirements before you're allowed to operate. So it is a very highly regulated, highly controlled, and highly engineered process.
Okay, we're going to get to Legislator Abinanti in 5 seconds. Just to let everybody know, in terms of managing expectations, we've only got about 10 minutes left, so we're not going to get to the resolution today. So if you're keeping score at home, we don't have to worry about the resolution. We'll address that at another meeting. So we'll devote the next 10 minutes to this discussion. And after Legislator Abinanti's question, I'm going to open it up to the floor for comments from the public. So
I too apologize, because as you've got a rotating group of legislators here, we just we've managed to keep four here at all times, but we've got so many other things going on that we're unlike Congress, we don't have large staffs where people can go to different meetings, and we've got to do it ourselves. I'm amazed by the answer that I heard to Legislator Kaplowitz's question. Did I miss something before? Is there an industry estimate on how you're going to make money on this? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't know what it's going to cost to take it out, you don't know what the process is going to be to take care of the water. You can't tell us what the jobs are. Why are you doing this? I mean, it's going to turn out to be a big bust in the end. It could cost billions of dollars, and we get nothing from it. Has anybody figured out that this is a cheaper way of getting gas than anywhere else?
Well, oil and gas extraction has always been financially risky for the companies that do it, and Marcellus is no different. And right now, nobody's making any money on the Marcellus in New York. As far as what it takes to make money, you have to, Brad, maybe you can answer that. I'm not sure I can.
Well, who's going to pay for this?
Well, right. Certainly those are individual company decisions, and as you can imagine, a lot of factors go into the full cycle economics that these companies run, and a lot of it depends on the natural gas price, which right now happens to be very low. We certainly feel, using reasonable assumptions, and I can't speak on behalf of individual companies, but there's enough assumptions out there that it will be profitable and that it will be a good thing for the state of New York, who currently imports 95% of its natural gas, while we're sitting on the second largest reservoir in the world. So I think to answer your question, yeah, there's an assumption that it will be profitable, it will make sense, and I think
what is that assumption based on?
Based on history, these natural gas have been extracted for
but not here.
I guess it has.
We know the expected depth of drilling. We can plug in the cost of drilling. We can make assumptions on the ultimate recoverable reserves from the Marcellus. We know that these wells cost several millions of dollars each.
But you haven't done the numbers. I mean, it was a very simple question. I thought Mr. Kaplowitz threw your softball, and I thought you were going to hit it out of the park, and instead, well, I'm feeling the whiff. You know, there's no, you're swinging and not even hitting the ball. It seems to me that you have to have some financial assumptions. Can I just ask you a question? I don't know much about the tax laws, but aren't there all kinds of favorable treatments for exploration of natural gas and oil and stuff like that in the tax laws? I mean, is this going to be paid for basically by federal government tax subsidies?
No, not at all. If you look at other industries who do receive subsidies, or industries that want to come into an area, the oil and gas industry does not have its hand out looking for any kind of tax breaks or subsidies, number one. Number two, the ad valorem tax that's in place right now is a very, it's a structured tax that funnels the tax revenues back into the municipalities, as I mentioned earlier, where the activity is occurring. But going back to your question about the economics, remember, I represent a trade association. I don't represent a Marcellus operator. So I really can't speak to the economics that a particular operator uses who's working, say, currently in Pennsylvania. They're looking at what they're doing in Pennsylvania right now, and I'm sure they're applying that to New York. But I don't have first-hand numbers for you because
Is there anybody who can give us some numbers that we know that this is even remotely possible to do economically?
I think if you talk to most of the gas operators, they're anxious to operate in New York. I think.
From the point of view of public policy makers, mm-hmm. I mean, we've got to look at this thing and say, you've got a risk on the environmental side, okay? Mm-hmm. You've got a significant cost in the use of water. Water is a commodity that is the amount of clean, drinkable water on the earth is a very small percentage of the entire amount of water. It's not like you're going to take water out of the ocean, use it here, and put it back. Mm-hmm. You're taking clean, drinkable water. And so I'm looking at this from the environmental point of view. I would be very nervous to say this is a good thing to do. Now, usually the argument on the other side is, well, you know what? It's going to be very good for New York because we've got all of this natural gas, and the price of natural gas for New York is going to be half of what you're paying for it now, and we're going to be able to extract it at one-third of the cost of what it costs to deliver natural gas to New York today. You're not making that argument. For all I know, it's going to be three times the cost of what it costs us in New York, and we're going to be stuck with it because it's here. And we may end up paying a lot more. So we asked a very simple question. Right, what's the economics? Nobody has an answer.
Well, the answer to that is as Brad tried to suggest, is that the operator would have that answer, not the trade association. He's not saying the answers aren't there. He's not saying that work has never been done. Obviously, it has to be done. But it'd be left to the operator to do that work. And as a trade association, we don't have a lot of access to that information. feel free to...
Well, certainly the risk and the expense is borne by the operators, but we have projections saying that if we were to duplicate what's happening in Pennsylvania, there's $3.8 billion in value added to their state economy, 48,000 jobs, $400 million in state and local tax revenues. Because we're not able to do it in New York, we can't say definitively this is what's going to happen. We might have a little less Marcellus than the state of Pennsylvania because it terminates or it becomes too shallow in our state. But even if we took half of those numbers, the economic impact is absolutely huge. And I don't think that's ever been...
Right. What is the cost?
As far as...
I made the point. Right. What's the cost?
But your question was about the economics to an operator or whatever. And again, those are particular companies' concerns to make decisions to come in and spend hundreds of millions of dollars in New York.
All right. You know what I'd like to do, just because the point has on both sides has been... Well made. We're running out of time. Did you have a final thought on that, Michael?
No, I just think it's in the industry's interest to put the time and the money in. Any reasonable legislator at a state level or local level wants to see the cost, if possible, of the environmental side. And we've heard it. It would be the industry's interest, I think, to come up with those numbers. And it would then show some good faith, and it would allow people to then challenge the numbers, accept them. That's how that process works. The other side is the softball that Tom's talking about, and I'm not as interested in an individual entity making a profit. I don't really care about that. What I do care about are the macro benefits that you began to describe, and I would like to see them in the short, the medium, and the long term. But I need to see, we all need to see the other side of the cost. If you provide $500 million in local and state costs to the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but you cost them $1.7 billion worth of environmental degradation, then in my book, you're down $1.2 million. And it was, you know, we lose it on every item, but we make it up in volume, the old joke. So it's not something that's beneficial. So I am, maybe I'm the only one in the world, but I like to see cost-benefit analyses because it gives me a chance to understand whether you've considered all the facets, and then I get to challenge your assumptions on the value of each of those facets, and then I get to look at the big picture and decide. And then there are two parts, in the New York City watershed and outside the New York City watershed. It seems that inside the New York City watershed, like MasterCard, it's probably priceless. That is, you could not put a cost on because of the potential environmental damage. But outside the watersheds, outside the drinking water areas, I'm intellectually open to the fact that, I don't know, maybe the societal good is greater than the societal cost. But unless you give us that analysis, we have no way of knowing.
All right, what I'd like to do, because we're out of time, so you've heard the concerns of legislators. I think it's a legitimate concern. You know, we can't always do an apples-to-apples comparison, but some sort of quantitative analysis, if not by you gentlemen, but by somebody, that helps us hang our hat on something, and the point's well taken. We're not doing anything on the resolution today, so there's time for more input from everybody. The other thing, Chris Crane just mentioned that there is some discussion of this in the state energy plan and the modeling of gas reserves. So if you might want to look to that source for some of your calculations, that would be helpful here. Mr. Strickland, are you still on the line? No, he's not. All right, we were going to give him the last word. Connie Coker, are you there? All right.
Did we lose everybody? Anybody well, still online?
Started talking, asking about well, who's going to pay for what.
All right. So what we would like to do, yes, absolutely. I want to thank everybody for coming. This is not the end of the discussion. It's just an ongoing discussion. We hope to take this up again very, very soon because we know there's more comment. And if something is to be done, it needs to be done sooner rather than later. So we appreciate all of you coming in. We appreciate your input. The dialogue goes both ways. So we thank you. We thank everybody for coming today. And we thank DEP, DEC, and Connie Coker from Rockland County. So thanks, everybody. With that, I entertain Legislator Kaplowitz's motion to close.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you. Thanks,
Jim. Thank you very much.